has treated China as the most serious threat to the U.S. and has lined up several countries in East Asia in coalition against China, which is why Beijing accuses the U.S. of again pursuing a containment policy. Russia, on the other hand, is treated as a threat only with respect to Ukraine. Vladimir Putin's imperial ambitions in Europe and his human rights record are not dealt with. Skinner acknowledges Ukraine's right to defend itself, but says U.S. involvement should be limited to military aid. That's not Trump's position, which in a nutshell is to appease Russia, end U.S. aid, and let Europe take the main responsibility for whatever is left of Ukraine after a ceasefire agreement. I'm guessing that Donald Trump is probably quite happy to lower Project 2025's visibility, since he sees himself as a stable genius who knows all there is to know about diplomacy and military strategy. There's no need for competing voices. It's enough that the Project 2025 endorses strongman government. All the rest is up to him. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 6, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertow and Grant Button. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Kathleen Shannon, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Will Walkie. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're speaking with Sarah Iannarone from the Street Trust about investing in safe streets for all.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Going into the first weekend in August, Portland police warned the public of a coming street takeover where folks from around the Northwest would be gathering on Portland streets to race cars illegally. Police say they were largely successful in shutting down these events, but that Portland remains an attractive destination for these kinds of things, and that's partly because of its infrastructure, or lack thereof. To explore the greater context and some long-term solutions, I'm joined today by Sarah Iannarone, the Executive Director of the Street Trust, Oregon's leading safe streets advocacy group. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. What was your first reaction to hearing about the street takeover that was planned for the first weekend in August?
I live in an area within hearing distance of I-205, 82nd Avenue, 92nd Avenue. So for us, street racing happens all the time. The fact that there was going to be a major takeover wasn't surprising. We've had these periodically in our city. It was interesting to see Portland police activating around this particular one. I'm not sure what incentivized that, but it was nice to see them taking an interest in keeping our streets safe. As you know, we're facing an epidemic of traffic fatalities on Portland streets, and we do need to make sure that they're safe for everyone, regardless of how they're traveling around them.
Well, let's get into that. What kind of dangers do these type of events pose for drivers, pedestrians, and cyclists?
Well, they're reckless and deadly, as we've seen. And honestly, they have a lot of impacts that people don't really may not realize. They damage the street. There was a street takeover near Lloyd Center, where my office is, a few months ago, and the infrastructure is absolutely wrecked. You can't see the bike lanes. You can't see the center lanes. You can't see even some of the curbs are a little damaged. So apart from the impact to human health and safety, it does affect our infrastructure, leaves particulate matter. I'm guessing it's pretty bad for the air quality of the bystanders as well, not to mention just the threats of a crash. It's really dangerous and deadly. Mm-hmm.
Well, the Street Trust has highlighted that PPB's law enforcement approach to this sort of event isn't necessarily the most effective. Obviously, they continue to happen, even though folks do get arrested and their cars repossessed and stuff like that. What are some alternatives?
So the Street Trust has long taken an approach that while law enforcement, we have traffic laws for a reason, so we want them enforced, there are a lot more equitable ways for us to enforce the laws and ensure safety on our streets. So one of the things that we advocated back when we had Commissioner Joanne Hardesty at the head of transportation was automated traffic enforcement, which we understand can be administered more equitably. We know that Portland police still disproportionately stop Black Portlanders in particular. Even most recent stats have that. So who the Portland police choose to stop or not is very subjective, and we believe that automated traffic enforcement can be more objective, potentially, if designed right and implemented right. We also believe that fines could be scaled based on the vehicle value or even income like they do in some countries. But apart from that, we believe that prevention is the best strategy. And there's so many ways we can approach this through a public health lens, which is really important because infrastructure is one piece, but all consumer protections we think about, whether it's seat belts or child caps on medicine, are there to help us prevent vulnerable people from inadvertently harming themselves or others. And we really want to design a transportation system that makes sure that even if there is human error, it's not just someone being distracted because they're on their cell phone while operating a motor vehicle. Maybe a bee flies into their car, right? We've all had that situation where something happens or someone jumps out in front of us, or maybe it's even an animal and we're startled. We want to make sure that there are protections in place so that someone who happens to be walking there maybe isn't killed. This is why we think about protecting people from different modes, separated bike lanes, raised sidewalks, and even thinking about keeping high volume, fast traffic separated from humans who are outside of automobiles. For instance, highways. You don't see people walking and biking on highways, or they're not supposed to be. So why would we have streets designed that could be used at highway speeds through places where people live, work, and play? Many of our streets, especially in East County, if you think about Marine Drive or any of the Strodes, as they're known, which are supposed to be streets, but they function as roads, they're really deadly, and people don't even understand, most people using the streets, operating a motor vehicle, walking or biking, that for every few miles faster that a motor vehicle is going when it collides with a human, the likelihood of that human surviving the crash precipitously drops, even at 5 and 10 mile per hour increments. Add on top of that the increased size of many of these vehicles, and humans just aren't surviving that collision with the automobile. So we really need to slow down these streets for everyday use, and those streets wouldn't be conducive to these types of street takeovers. It would be impossible to take them over.
Well, you were mentioning some of the qualities of these streets, and so many of them are in Portland's high crash network where this stuff is happening and has a long legacy of being really dangerous for folks using the road in all types of different ways. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of the high crash network, and you know, what progress have you seen Portland make towards dealing with those, or what still needs to be done?
To PBOT's credit, I do want to point your listeners toward the PBOT Equity Matrix, where they have done a nice job of identifying these high crash corridors and intersections. And they've also identified high equity areas, which are places where the first language spoken at home may not be English, where people living in lower incomes reside, where BIPOC communities reside. And so overlaying those in the equity map to target investments in those areas. And they have worked to make targeted investments, especially in East Portland and Northeast Portland. But one of the problems is that these streets are still far too conducive to fast-moving motor vehicles. So as I said, just a few miles, a car going 45 or 50 down one of these wide roadways, which all of us have seen, could be a life or death choice over just going 25 or 30. And we haven't done enough to reduce speeds in these areas. And you can't only do that through behavior change. You need to do it through infrastructure. You don't see people moving at those speeds at 22nd and Division at the rate that you do at 122nd Division. And that's design. It's the same car, right? They're moving from one end of the corridor to another. Another piece really would be driver education and safety education. I think a lot of these younger drivers in particular are maybe getting basic driver ed in school, but they're not really understanding the impacts of their choices on their own lives, what that could mean for their future employment if they get a criminal record from this activity, what that could mean for their families, the costs if they actually end up hurting someone or hurting themselves, what that could mean for them. So we could do a lot more intervention the same way we put, you know, warnings on cigarette packs and restrict youth from having access to that. We don't want people doing things inadvertently that harm them when they may not know that it's harmful.
Well, right, especially thinking about street racing, this is sort of thrill-seeking behavior that attracts definitely a younger crowd. Is that something, do you know if that's been done, that kind of education has been done for drivers other places?
Well, we've seen it effective, and not to over-index on smoking, but we have seen over decades where a concerted investment to reduce smoking through a variety of enforcement and education mechanisms really does help move the needle on a public health situation. And that's why the Street Trust calls for us treating traffic violence and reckless driving as a public health epidemic. And we need those supports in place so that from very early age, we really glamorize driving now. Now that I work in traffic safety, I can even be watching, like, say, a cartoon with a young friend, you know, or someone in my community, and you see this car chase and it's really funny and someone's getting crashed up. And I have a visceral reaction. I don't like seeing that because I know in my everyday life, if that happens, there's a family on the receiving end of that violence whose life is irreversibly affected sometimes. And so I do think that we need to think more holistically about what we glamorize in terms of mobility in our communities and how we can make some of the other modes more exciting. And also, young people are just going to thrill seek. It's what they do. Sometimes you'll hear, oh, these kids are skateboarding too fast, or they're riding their bikes too fast, or they're riding their e-bikes too fast. And honestly, I think we need to create spaces for them to be able to do some of this stuff, not disinvesting in parks and recreation areas. But what would it mean to host an invitational at the Portland Raceway, potentially, right? And just let them use it. Could we fund that instead of funding police, and instead of them doing this on a public street? You know, I don't know if we could insure it, but I do think there are people who know more about that who could get creative with our investments and make sure that they are heading folks in the right direction.
Yeah, I was very interested to hear about this more equity-centered approach in terms of law enforcement. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, that racial profiling of Portland police is a pretty well-known phenomenon here that they haven't effectively been able to address. So the automated traffic enforcement is one approach. But I also think that when we focus our investments to prevent this racing in those high equity areas, we'll have more equitable outcomes. So you see some improvements on 82nd Avenue. We need to see them on the entire high crash network with urgency. Marine Drive in particular is quite deadly. And I guess when the police say this place is attractive for that racing, it's because we have roads like that that they see as wide open spaces where they can do this behavior. If we didn't have those, they wouldn't be able to do it.
Right, like you mentioned, they're not racing 22nd and Division.
Yeah.
What kind of efforts have been made at the state level to address street racing?
So back in 2023, back when Governor Kotek was still in the House, they did pass more strict consequences for people who were caught doing this. That included increased jail time and even vehicle forfeiture. So I do think law enforcement has more tools. On the flip side, I don't like to see any young people funneled into our criminal justice system unnecessarily when that could be prevented. It has serious consequences for their life outcomes subsequently. So what we want to do is invest in keeping them out of that behavior in the first place, so that they understand there could be really serious consequences at the other end of their decisions, including life or death for them or others, and see if we can steer them in a different direction through, again, education, behavior change, and encouragement in other areas. That said, I do think that some countries have done a better job of making sure that, I use the word recidivism, but there are a small subset of the population who engage in this behavior again and again. And what we see is really serious consequences for folks that aren't carceral. For instance, vehicle forfeiture, losing your license, and even speed regulators and other things that would be installed on your vehicle, similar to if you're a repeat offender for driving while intoxicated, so that you're actually, the cars just aren't allowed to go that fast. So we know that the technology exists. We geofence the scooters so they can't go in parks, and we have speed regulators on e-bikes, and I'm not sure why we don't use that technology for motor vehicles as well. That would be a federal issue, though, not the state.
Right, right. Are Portland police tracking this kind of thing from what you understand from a data perspective and taking their strategies from those findings?
From what they've said, I don't get the indication. The OPB published a story that the police officer they quoted said they're not able to track this information. I'm always surprised at the storytelling that PPB does around their activities. It's hard to track. It's not very transparent. So the more we can daylight why PPB does what it does with the resources it has and what outcomes they have would be really interesting. I saw a lot of media circulating about how this weekend was such a success. But if you talk to anyone in the community, these things still go on all around our city a lot. So maybe this one point in time was potentially successful. But I would equate that something along the lines of the homeless sweeps where they clear one corner and it just pops up on another corner. You can't address systemic solutions with point in time interventions. And often law enforcement, it's hard to say what the consequences will be, you know, downstream from this intervention, whether we'll have positive outcomes or not. I'm not sure that they're tracking at that level of a fine grain or with a, say, a partner in higher education or public health who could really help them fine tune their activities for the optimal outcomes.
Well, like you mentioned, systemic problems, systemic solutions, and traffic calming is one of those. What are some of the criteria that you assess those on?
Well, leading with race is really important. So if you talk to the folks at Multnomah County Health Department who've really been doing a great job in our community, leading with race is critical to make sure that you have equitable outcomes with whatever you're doing. But in particular, public health, it helps us design a system that's going to be more equitable for most people. The example that we often use is the sidewalk curb cut, right? The little ramp at the edge. So instead of having to step down the curb, you can just roll easily into the street. Well, those are designed for ADA access for people using a mobility device like a wheelchair. Think about how your life has improved because they're there, whether you're pulling a kid in a wagon, pushing a stroller, maybe pulling a shopping cart, you know, home from the bus stop. They make your life easier, or even have a broken leg, right? So when we make interventions based on people who are most harmed by the system, we all benefit. So if we were to look at the data and make those interventions in urban space, in education, around ameliorating racial disparities, we would start to chip away at this problem. But I feel like Portland has a hard time just making that commitment and doubling down on it. We tend to equivocate a little bit. We say Black Lives Matter, but then we don't spend the money and target the investments to make sure that they do and that people aren't killed through a lack of investment, which is basically why we have the public health epidemic.
Well, in the advocacy work that you do, do you encounter misconceptions that people may have about how to make streets safer?
I don't know if it's so much misconceptions, but what we do know is that transportation and safe streets aren't really even in people's top 10 priorities for the way that they're looking at the safety of our communities. And we know that the streets are the lifelines of our communities. You can't get from home to work or home to school or home to your doctor without them, a transportation system. So community mobility should be built into our housing crisis, our public health crisis, and even just thinking about all of the challenges we've had around, say, ADA access to sidewalks and camping, right? So thinking about streets as part of the livability equation is really important, and we need to get the public more aware of that. At the end of the day, I think most people don't understand that cars slowing down is so critical. Again, if a car runs into me going 20 miles per hour, I might have a chance of surviving. You hit 40, that's like a fraction of that chance. So really slowing down every 5 miles per hour, every 10 miles per hour really counts, even at 40, 30, 20. So we often say 20 is plenty. And we really do think that where there are people walking, rolling, biking, trying to access transit, people driving should go very, very, very slowly. So, and also one of the things that we need to understand is that we are horrible at funding our transportation system. Per household, we pay the least of the Western states. The only worse state than us is Montana. So compared to, say, California or even Utah or Idaho, Oregonians are not really paying for our transportation system in the way that would make us allow us to pay for these improvements. So we really need to commit in the 2025 legislative session to move Oregon forward through a more concerted safe streets investment strategy for all of us, because it doesn't end at City of Portland. You've got Gresham at one side, you know, Washington County, Clackamas County, and our friends across the state don't have safe streets either. And as much as we like spending billions of dollars on highway mega projects, I think we should be spending billions of dollars on a complete streets, Main Street strategy for all of us to move about safely and have a happy, healthy life.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about the Street Trust or about this issue, are there resources that you recommend?
Sure. You can visit the Street Trust website at thestreettrust.org. You'll be able to find all the links to at least the campaigns that we're working on, and definitely stay in tune with the 2025 transportation package. And we're happy to come back and talk with you more about that, or send some of our colleagues from the Move Oregon Forward campaign here to make sure that we have investments that are going to keep us all healthy and safe, and also that accountability and transparency piece is important as well. So some of the things that we're thinking about are reducing greenhouse gas emissions, reducing traffic fatalities through the investments we make. And if the public isn't making this a priority, then their lawmakers aren't going to make it a priority. And we just want to make sure that Oregonians know that there's an opportunity to make it a priority, and we hope that they do. So visit our website, find out more about it, and we'll get you involved.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't touch on?
Be safe and have fun out there. Our streets should be really cool if we're using them right. So I hope you all have a safe, happy summer.
Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
That was Sarah Iannarone, the executive director of the Street Trust, Oregon's leading safe streets advocacy group. We're talking about some of what her organization does, especially in light of the recent street takeover that Portland police busted up the first weekend in August. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kimberly Cortez, reporting intern at Street Roots, to talk about her story for the paper. It's called City Contractors Post Sweep Notifications Amid Heat Wave. Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency July 2nd due to extreme heat, but city contractors continued posting sweep notifications on homeless encampments throughout the emergency. Welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Hi, Althea.
Thank you so much for being here. So, data analysis by Street Roots found that a city contractor, Rapid Response BioClean, posted 121 encampment sweep notifications during the heat wave and during the state of emergency. How did you determine this, and what is so significant about it?
Yeah, so the Homeless and Urban Camping Impact Reduction Program, or HUCURP, posts sort of this data every single week, just giving the public an insight on how many encampments are sleeping a week, you know, how many of those people went to shelters. And we were aware of postings happening, or actual sweeps happening, because this isn't the first time that the city has said that they were going to pause, you know, sleeping encampments during an extreme weather emergency. In the story, I talk about how this happened in 2022. So we were sort of aware that something might have happened during that, you know, first week of July, where, you know, there's just record-breaking heat. So the analysis that we did was from that data that was shared with us. And what we found was that while the city was not necessarily claiming that they were sweeping, they were still posting these notifications. And, you know, 121 of those were posted for removal July 3rd through July 9th. And in between those dates, they were still posting sweep notifications when temperatures were exceeding 99 degrees or reaching that. And while the city is technically allowed to do that, despite what they lay out in their own policy around stopping sweeps during heat emergencies or other weather-related emergencies, they were still sweeping when it was in the mid-90s the following week. So really what we found was that, you know, even though there's this difference between posting the notifications and actually sweeping, there was still harm being done.
I think it's also worth noting that in your reporting, you talk about how the story was shifting as you were talking to HUCRP about this and what they were claiming that the city contractor Rapid Response BioClean was up to. Just a brief quote. Laura Rood, HUCRP Communications and Data Coordinator, initially told Street Roots the city's contractors only collected trash during the heat wave. In a July 10th email, Rood later acknowledged the city also had contractors continue posting sweep notifications in a July 15 email.
Yeah, when we initially asked for the data, they told us, you know, there might not be as many encampment removals because we stopped having crews doing sweeps, and they were just picking up garbage. And those days where it was really hot, the crews were just out until 12 p.m., so they had a shortened work day that week of the heat wave. But when the HUCRP source later shared some notes with us from the actual crew, we found that they did at least sweep one encampment during the days that they said that they were just picking up garbage. The crew notes say, you know, campers got their stuff and left. This was marked as removed.
So we know that there was sweep postings and some sweeps that were happening during this time. How do people usually react when they see that sign, when they see the sweep posting near where they've been sleeping?
Sweep notifications inform homeless Portlanders that city contractors will return in 72 hours to 10 days to remove their encampments. But what homeless Portlanders have told us before is that they leave before that initial 72-hour period even is up, because when contractors do come and sweep, it typically involves the contractors seizing and potentially disposing any property. So to ensure that they can get as many of their belongings as possible, sometimes these belongings are also crucial to getting into a traditional shelter. They leave before that initial time period is up. And so I think that's where it gets sort of tricky with the city's own policy, is that, you know, those sweep notifications that they were giving to encampment sites on the days that it said that it was just picking up garbage, that the 10-day period still extends to when they actually did those. So it's kind of complicated, the differentiation between posting and actually sweeping. But what advocates also told us was that they saw and witnessed and have peers that witnessed sweeps occurring. So it makes you question whether the data that the city is having, that the city is collecting, paints an accurate picture of what's really happening on the street.
Well, yeah, let's go there, right? Like you said, there's the official account of what happened and when, what rapid response crews were doing during the heat wave, but advocates have a different story. Let's go into that. What did they see?
Yeah, so I reached out to Portland Street Medicine, which regularly provides healthcare and other important resources for homeless Portlanders on the street. And when I asked them, you know, this is what the city is saying, they said that they were not removing any encampments. What do you have to say? Almost all of them had a rebuttal. One person said that they saw sweeps occurring in Old Town. Another person said that, you know, right when they were looking at the city's dashboard, they connected with someone who was helping a homeless Portlander not get swept the days that the heat were very excessive. So I think what advocates are sort of asking the city is for more transparency on city policy. You know, they have this differentiation between posting and actually sweeping, but their experience is different, and some clarity on what their procedure actually is during extreme weather events is crucial to understanding what kind of resources and other needs that they would need to supply homeless Portlanders owners with.
What do you want readers and listeners to take away from this story?
I think something that I want readers to think about is that this is not going to be the last extreme weather event that Portlanders experience in the coming years. There's this really kind of nuanced point about climate-related events and how those will only escalate in time as we see climate change worsen. And the city is not necessarily putting forth a transparent or clear plan to what it's going to do when those events happen and how that pertains to its response to homelessness in Portland. You know, that same week that that heat emergency happened and the heat wave happened, it was the first week of the camping ban that was supposed to be put in place. And so there needs to be more transparency and clearer guidelines on what happens when, you know, it's 100 degrees, what happens when it's less than 20 degrees, and how to respond and make sure that lives aren't lost.
That was Kimberly Cortez, reporting intern at Street Roots, speaking with me about her latest story for the paper. It's called City Contractors Post Sweep Notifications Amid Heat Wave. Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency July 2nd due to extreme heat, but city contractors continued posting sweep notifications on homeless encampments throughout the emergency. More information on that story is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
The 2024 election is coming, and we at KBOO want to make sure your voice is heard. Take KBOO's election agenda survey and help our volunteer reporters and programmers cover the 2024 election.